Hello, my name's David Lankus. I'm a professor at Syracuse University's iSchool, and I apologize for my appearance, but actually I'm doing this from the hospital room in the chemo ward at Upstate Medical University. That's actually my pump pumping drugs into me as we speak, so pardon me if I get a little disoriented. I promise for those of you who are made uncomfortable by the informality or the medical nature of my placement, I will make sense soon towards the end. It does actually relate. But it's also a real privilege of me to present to you. Sorry, I'm not going to be able to do it in person. I hope you can see the presentation, get what you want, and if you'll notice on the bottom of my slides or my website where I'll post a screencast of this, and you also have contact information to let me know what I got right, what I got wrong, what we agree with, and have a conversation. So I want to talk about the good, the bad, and the great. And really, this all stems from a tweet I put out a while ago. Look like this, that bad libraries build collections, good libraries build services, great libraries build communities. And I got a lot of interesting interaction, a lot of yes, absolutely, a lot of well, what do you mean? Isn't this and that and that? And so I wanted to give you a little bit of sense of what I mean by that. And I think it really talks to the larger concept of how libraries are changing and how we think about libraries, how we prepare librarians, and the role of librarians in what they do. That it's not just a building, a stack, and a collection, but really is the work that you do in your setting, in your community that matters. But let's break this down a little bit more. So this is pithy and delightful, but what does it mean? I should say, however, we have a rule at Syracuse, at the iSchool. If you come to speak to us, you have to give us a presentation in a It's tweetable. You have to give us a summary of your presentation. It's tweetable, and if you can't do it, you can't come. We find it helps speed things along. So this is the pithy version. Let's go to the long version, and I want to start with this concept of what do I mean by bad libraries build collections? Don't all libraries build collections? Shouldn't any library build collections? Don't the great libraries of the world build collections? Do collections not matter? Do you hate books? Well, let's talk a little bit about it. And really, it's more about an attitude about collections than it is about the collections themselves. So I'm going to talk about sort of four problems with the idea of being collection-centric and why it's a problem and how you can know if it is a problem. And I'll start with the psychics in the Ivy League. I spent a great summer at an Ivy League university library, which I will not mention which one. But it's in Boston. And so I was talking with their head of collections, and I said, you know, I had this idea. I was a big reference guy then. I said, you know, we answer all these reference questions, and we answer them online, and we answer them at desk. And what if we looked at trends in the reference collection? We looked at what kind of questions people were asking, and we looked at the resources that were filling, and we tracked them, and we could use that to feed into collection development. We could make sure that when we're doing our collection development and acquisition, we build it based on the questions people are asking. To which point, this very wonderful, distinguished acquisitions librarian sort of looked at me and said, you know, we build collections for the next generation. And it was a really interesting stopping moment for me because, you know, it was clearly this was not a point to begin a further conversation. That's one of those statements that sort of tends to stop conversations a bit because what do you say at that point? Screw the next generation? And I don't know. But it really, as I was thinking about this, I was going, oh my God, what an amazing gift this person has that they can look into the future and know what the collections they're going to need are. Right? And the truth is, of course, we don't know what the collections of the future are going to be. We don't know what we're purchasing now that will be useless, what we're purchasing now that will be priceless. We make some good guesses. We have some good guesses, and we have some techniques that we try and do it. But ultimately, this idea of we build collections for the next generation just in case this subpopulation. Have you asked that population? No, but we know what they need, right? That's another form of psychic collection building that we sort of sit in our offices and go, oh, we need more popular reading. Oh, this is going to be the teen fantasy book of the year award, whatever it is. Or, oh, we know that if it's a Caldecott winner, that's guaranteed to be high circulation. This idea that somehow we can look at the collection, we can look at our own expertise, that we can somehow feel the vibe of what's going on, and that's going to determine what we collect. This is a problem. because it means that we're facing the collection. When you worry about things like completeness, do we have all of a series? Do we have the continuation of a series? Do we have everything from this publisher? If we look at all of the variables about what we collect based not upon what's going out, what the community wants, what the community needs, and where they're headed, but instead on the collection itself, what are we really focusing on? And before you say that you don't subscribe to the psychic view of collection development, I ask you to take a look at your budget. Between your acquisitions budget, between your cataloging budget, between your interlibrary loan, between shelving, circulation, maintenance, the amount of time we spend on the collection, shelving, and circulation and such, how much of your budget is dedicated to a collection, and how much of it is dedicated to services, outreach, those kinds of things? We'll talk about that again in a second. But the truth is that we're all a little collection-centric. We're collection-centric for lots of reasons. We're collection-centric because, let's face it, that's really what set libraries apart. When libraries were in massive growth phase, when we were looking at really the idea of public library and academic libraries and building them up, this idea of creating a complete collection, creating a comprehensive collection, was a grand idea. And in the era of information scarcity, when buying books and materials, and mostly printed documents, was a valuable exercise to do, when we really began to say, if we could provide our communities with this collection of materials, that is a great asset. While we believed that vision of information scarcity, something interesting happened. Information became much less scarce. And I'm not talking the internet and Google like this happened in the last 20 years. This started around the mid-century after World War I and then World War II, when printing and ink cost and paper cost plummeted. And publishers realized that by increasing not only the number of volumes, but the number of titles they could provide, they could increase their business. And so if a few hundred of their titles died, but five of them made it, they still had a viable business model, that why not do 200 titles and 400 titles and 800 titles? And you can see this collision of cheaper printing cost, expansion in titles, hit a smack dab in this idea of being complete and collection-centric, and our collections blossomed and our volume went crazy. And now when we live in a world where information is not so scarce, back into that 20 years and that 10 years when the internet and ubiquitous connection came about, now we're still sort of thinking information scarcity, when in truth the scarcity is not in finding our information or our volumes. The scarcity is in the intention of those people that we serve. It's not that I can't find 500 different descriptions of a book or reviews of a place to eat. The problem is I can find 500 and I need two. That's a shift in where that information is. But we still look at this idea of volumes, of centric, of collection size as being important. So, willing to point fingers at myself, this is the second page of two of a sheet that we send out to prospective students and parents, right? This is our brag sheet. This is, come to Syracuse, we love it. And what do we say about the library? Well, what we say about the library is, look how much stuff we have! 3.8 million volumes and 7.6 microform collections, because there isn't an undergraduate in the world coming to take sports management that doesn't say, if it doesn't have a powerful microform collection, I'm not going, right? We have our current periodicals and our electronic books and lots of stuff. We have stuff, stuff, stuff. We love stuff. We have it. We can count it. We can brag about it. And this doesn't come from nowhere. This doesn't come just from the fact that we like books and we have stuff, right? This is stuff that the library is putting out to itself and to the university to brag about itself. It's the easiest way to get your finger on what a library is, right? It's easy to say that. It's hard to talk about student outcomes. It's hard to talk about services. It's hard to talk about, you know, how can we improve performance. And let's face it, we have a really hard time in academic libraries saying, this person got an A because of this contribution of the library. But we also see it in how we sort of judge ourselves. I mean, let's face it, the ARL dumping dilemma came from this. Now, ARL has new statistics and outcomes. But the big thing they did when you were talking about being an ARL library and ranked and comparing to your peer institutions is you looked at volume count. And so what happened is you saw large academic libraries, Harvard and MIT and all these folks, that would actively weed their collections and they'd throw them to the dumpster. And what would happen? Well, up-and-coming libraries that wanted to get big numbers to brag about, that wanted to increase their volume collection, would go and, in essence, buy or get for free these wonderful discards from the Ivy League, but they would bump up, so now they had 3.8 million volumes and all this other stuff. So they could bump up and play the statistics. this idea of how we count things in libraries has become an obsession, and our collection is the easiest thing to count. In fact, let's face it, in public libraries, it's much better to put that number out there than how many librarians we're hiring, because they cost real money. Please. Right. But it's different than that, right? We see this not only in our own sort of press material. Here's OCLC WorldCat, and what do they brag about? 2 billion items available through here from 10,000 libraries worldwide. We love our numbers. But I want you to do something very interesting. Go to WorldCat. You'll see this. This is their homepage. This is the front thing. This is the library of libraries, what they push out. And then I want you to go take a look at a service like Netflix. Right, you can look at Amazon if you want. You can look at iTunes, Apple iTunes. And I want you, when you're on Apple iTunes or Netflix, I want you to find that number. I want you to find how many DVDs or movies or streaming things or songs those services have. Because you won't. I'll tell you, I dug around. And in Netflix, this is the closest I could get. We have thousands of other movies and TV episodes. Thousands could mean 2,000, could mean 20,000, could mean 50,000. Right? It's a nice ambiguous number. Now, why is it? Is it because they're afraid or they're ashamed at how small their collection is? Is it because they don't want to, you know, well, we look puny against other people? What's very interesting in the search engine business, about 10 years ago, search engines used to brag about how many pages they indexed. They no longer brag about that because what they've realized on the internet is the number of pages doesn't equal quality. There's a lot of crap on the internet. There's a lot of repetitive pages. There are a lot of short-lived pages. There are a lot of pages meant to catch people's attentions and break rankings in the search engines. Numbers to Google, numbers to Netflix mean something very different, and they're not that important. And in fact, the reason Netflix doesn't show you that big number up front isn't because they're ashamed of their numbers. It's actually based on something called the paradox of choice. This is Barry Schwartz of Swarthmore College. He's a psychologist, and he's done a lot of interesting studies, and he's looked at this idea of numbers. And what he came up with, and it's brilliant, is this notion of a paradox of choice. And it goes something like this. He talks about how he likes blue jeans. He wears jeans. He goes, and it used to be that you would go to a store and you had like two pairs of jeans, you know, women's and men's. And then maybe you had three pairs of jeans. You had boot cut, straight cut, relaxed fit. He goes, and you try them on, and what happens is you would walk out of the store and it wouldn't quite fit right, but it wasn't your fault because they really just only made three choices, right? So you had the best of the three choices. He goes, go now to Levi's and try and buy a pair of jeans. They got 501s and 401s and 631s and 981s and all these different numbers and boot cuts and straight cuts and this cut and that cut. He goes, there are a ton of choices. There are more choices now than you have time. He goes, you cannot try on all the jeans. So the paradox is that you will eventually walk out and make a decision. You will buy a pair of jeans. And that pair of jeans will fit better than back when you could choose between the three. This will be the best fitting pair of jeans that you've ever worn. But you will be unsatisfied with your choice. He says, the reason you're going to be unsatisfied is because now you know that there are other options you didn't explore. And there is a chance that those other options you didn't explore would have been better than the ones that you're wearing. He says, but it gets worse than that. He goes, the fact that you didn't explore them means that you are at fault for not having a better pair of jeans. It's not the fact that the Levi's produced a bunch. It's the fact that you didn't take the time to try them all on and do your due diligence. You picked a convenient choice, and you always have this doubt that there's something better out there that you haven't picked. And so when you look at Netflix and iTunes and Amazon and all of these services, the reason they hide that number for you is not because they're ashamed of it or they're hiding it. Those are actually really good numbers. It's because they've realized that the value of the collection, the value of the stuff, is not the total number of options. In fact, the larger the number of options, the greater the disappointment people can have with the collection. Instead, the value comes from selection. From choice. The value of Netflix is not in how many things they have to borrow, it's how precise their recommendations can be, and how precise they can get you to the right DVD. Based on what you've watched before, watch this one. That selectivity, that narrowing of choice is actually more powerful in the human mind than the overabundance of choice. The overabundance of choice can lead to paralysis, can lead to this paradox of choice, can lead to discontentment. So to talk about being collection-centric isn't just a matter of saying, oh, great, we have lots of stuff, or, oh, we shouldn't brag about the amount of stuff, or even that the amount of stuff we have is unimportant. It's more a matter of what are we doing with that stuff? What are we presenting to our users, our members, as we'll talk about in a moment? Right? So when we being collection-centric, we have to deal with the fact that, one, the collection in and of itself does not have value. In fact, the value of a very large collection may be discontent in those who seek to use it. It's the idea that what's easy to count may not be the most important thing to count. And worse, if we can constantly present the library as a collection, a collection, a collection, a collection. Oh my God, they opened a library in Texas without any books in it. How is that a library? If we constantly present that and we don't talk about the value of librarians, and we don't talk about the value of the impact that collection has on their community, then eventually people will say, well, we have big collections. We can store a bunch of books in a warehouse. We can just buy lots of stuff. We don't need a library. We'll just go license it direct from Elsevier. We'll just go license directly from Overdrive. We'll just go buy this stuff directly and provide it to our citizens, members, students, faculty, what have you, regardless of having a human being in the middle of it. So by pushing and looking at the collection, the reason I talk about bad libraries looking solely at the collection is we're not serving our people necessarily well because we're not looking to evaluate that. And we're not serving ourselves well because ultimately we're making the collection more important than the activity and the action of collecting, of sorting, of serving, of sharing, of making people's life better. So let's move on from this idea of bad libraries to talk about what good libraries do. Good libraries build services. So what do I mean by that? Well, let me tell you the story of the National Science Digital Library and the difference between a service approach and a collection approach. So the National Science Digital Library was an attempt by the National Science Foundation to take all this wonderful research into digitization and digital libraries and metadata and search engines and create a functioning working library around science that could be used primarily in education, primary, secondary, informal, higher ed. And so what they did is they formed two big pots of money and they funded people on two different tracks. The first track is what they called the collections track. So they gave them money to, for example, to what you're seeing here is a molecular diagram of testosterone, just in case you cared. They used to give them out on cards. It was very exciting. That and caffeine. And the idea is that they gave this money to a university to build all these 3D models of molecules. They gave another money to the creation of Confucian texts, of different biology lessons, to create whole collections of digital artifacts, to create whole collections of science experiments, etc. And they said, your job is to go get the stuff, digitize it, collect it, put it on hard drives. You're going to make collections. They took a second pot of money and they gave it to services. We were one, in all sort of fairness. Ours was to answer questions so that if people, as they were using the collections, had questions, we could find scientists and experts who could answer their questions. But there were all kinds of services, visualization services, metadata services for cataloging. There were graphing services. There were storage services. There were all different kinds of really cool services. Back to like that Netflix thing where you could just get the recommendation for this is what you need. But a problem happened on the way to a National Science Digital Library, which is the idea is they funded these people separately. And so after about 4 or 5 years, they told the services people, all right, the collections are done. Go get them. Go apply your services to them. And the services said, no problem. Here we go. We're going to do cataloging. We're going to do metadata assignment. We're going to do visualization. We're going to do search so you can search across the entire NSDL. We're going to answer questions. And they walked over to the collections. They said to the collections, give us your stuff. And the collection said, here's a URL. And it wasn't a URL to a big file that could be downloaded. It wasn't a URL to 500,000 molecular models. It was a URL to a website that the collections had built. When they were building their collections, the first thing they had did is they organized them. They organized them by, you know, organic types or hydrogen types or these kinds of molecules or those kinds of molecules. And they built a hierarchy and they built their own search engine and a specialized search engine just for molecular stuff. And so when the services showed up with search and such, the first thing they had to reckon with is these aren't collections. They're services. When you collect 500 books and you put them on a shelf, that's a service. It's called access. When you take those 500 books and you put them in a given order by classification scheme, that's a service. when you let the public come in and get at those books and not have them chained to the shelf, that's a service. So really the only time a user, a patron, comes in and utilizes a library of any sort, virtual or in person, they're using a service. You providing them space is a service. You providing them a civil environment is a service. You providing them a card is a service. They can't get at a collection without going through a service like classification, shelving, organization, circulation, etc. So really, collections exist in the pure form, but they are completely useless without services. So we need to begin to think of libraries not as collections, really as collection of collections, right? We have our licensed resources and our physical resources. But we need to think of our libraries as a set of services that allow people to get to collections, yes, but as we're going to see in a second, lots of other things. In fact, let's look at that now, right? So if we even thought about here is the stuff and there is our patron or our user, we say, let us get you there. We provide card catalogs in the old days. Today we provide online public access catalogs. That's a service. When you go to the shelves are organized by call number, for example, or by BISAC number, or whatever it is. That's a service. When we let them do it from 9 to 5 during the day, that's a service. When we let them pull the book out and read it in a study carrel or on a table, that's a service. So we see this idea that that's a service. But if we stopped here, that's still a collection-centric way of thinking, right? We have all these collections, and we're putting all these services on top of them to help people get to the collection. Think about reference for a moment. Reference used to really very much seen as a service of the collection. Really was a band-aid for bad finding aids, right? When people couldn't figure out the card catalog or couldn't figure out the indexes, they'd go to a librarian, and the librarian would provide a reference, a pointer to the collection. We used to think about the way you answer the collection, answer a reference question was first to get them to the best resource. In other words, everything was about finding and serving the collection. But now we know that when people come in and they have questions, a book, a piece of material may not be the answer. They may need to get to training. That training may have nothing to do with the collection. We may provide Rosetta Stone online so people can do language services or basic computer services, basic computer literacy services. And so the services go beyond the collection. We have job hunting services. So people come in and we help them fill out materials. We help them find, you know, do finding aids and search job sites and put together their resumes and print out resumes and all these kinds of things. And we see services now as the primary thing that a library does, one of which is the collection, one of which is all these other services. But even then, this is only gets us to good, because really built into this is an assumption that what the library has to provide, what the users can get from us, is the limit of what the library can provide. What do I mean? So let's move on, right? So if good, bad libraries build collections, meaning they solely focus on the collection as a collection, and good libraries build services, meaning they see the collection as a service, but they see all these other ways of fulfilling user or patron needs as services, as good. What do I mean by great? And what do you mean by build community? Well, let's take this example again. So we have these folks, and they're coming in, and they're consuming stuff from the library, meaning we provide them with the training. We provide them with the job site. We provide them with the licensed resources. We provide them with computer access time. We provide them with the space. In essence, they are using services that we as the library control, provide, budget for, and they simply consume them. I mean, I always really hate the term user. I mean, do you really want to be a user, someone who uses somebody? Is that really what we aspire to in our life? I don't think so. I think we really want to be someone that is of the community and part of the community. And the first is a realization that that user, or as I call them, member of the library, and we'll see why in a second, doesn't come in a vacuum. They don't come to the library fresh, where we're the first ones. It's like the most insulting reference question you can ask is, well, have you searched Google? And their answer is, well, have you, do you breathe? Of course I've searched Google. That's why I'm here. It failed. right? We know that that person comes with other ideas, other thoughts, and there are other resources. So yes, they may well come to the library to get things that we own and we possess. They may come to get things that are too expensive to get on their own, million-dollar databases, large collections of encyclopedia, whatever, the latest Danielle Steele. But we know that they themselves have collections of materials and books and images and thoughts and expertise and dreams and aspirations. Eli Nyberger, who's the associate director of the Ann Arbor District Library, told a story about how he had a member come in, and he said, well, you know how I can search for a book through the catalog? And Eli said, yes. He goes, you know how I can use the same system to find out if the book is here or at a branch library? And Eli said, yes. And the member said, why can't I put my collection so that someone comes in, they can search to find out whether it's here or in a branch, or in my house? I'm perfectly willing to lend them the books and bring them in. Now, if you're a service-specific or collection-centric or library institutional thinker, that is bizarre and crazy and a stupid wild thought. But if you suddenly think, wait a minute, the library is a platform that helps community members get what they need. And what they may need is not only to get from each other, but to share. A community need maybe to share their own expertise, their own collections, their own thoughts, then suddenly it's not crazy. Then what happens is the library becomes a place not simply to share what we have, we being the library and our budget, but a platform to get things that we possess, but also that the community can begin to share its own resources, its own expertise, its own books, its own materials, its own podcasts. And they can begin to connect to each other. Expertise. The story of a library member who was a warehouse worker, but he was also a Civil War buff. And he came in and he said, you know, I really am interested in the Civil War, and I know a lot about the Civil War. And one of the librarians said, would you be willing to give a lecture on the Civil War? And he said, sure, that'd be great. And so first time they set it up classroom style, and there was the warehouse worker, and he was talking about the Civil War, and suddenly all these other Civil War buffs were listening, but they also began talking back, and by the third and fourth meeting, they were no longer in lecture style, they were in a round style, and they were sharing, and then they would come up with, and they would go to the library and say, we would love if we could get this resource, or we have these resources, can we put them here in this shelf? And suddenly, this whole Civil War buff thing of the community became enabled by the library. But it wasn't because of the library's collection policy, and it wasn't because of service. It was because the library provided a platform for that community to get together and share and utilize resources. And that's what we're beginning to talk about moving beyond the idea of simply the idea that a good library is a bunch of services. Because what a library is seeking to do is to improve its community. It's not, as we've started, seeking to improve its collection. It only will seek to improve its collection if it is of service. And it knows that the services these days go well beyond what can be purchased and put on a shelf or what can be licensed and put on a screen. We know that it can be tutorials, it can be learning environments, it can be job-seeking services. And we know that it's not a matter of the librarian knowing it all. There was a big discussion about 3D printing and makerspaces in public libraries. Should they do it? And there was a big argument about libraries, should they get in the makerspace environment? And I said, absolutely, they should get 3D printers and makerspaces and go for it. And I had one very intelligent response that said, okay, so librarians now need to learn about 3D printing and 3D modeling and this programming language and sending these vector diagrams. And I said, no, stop. It's the last thing the librarian needs to know. The librarian needs to know their community well enough to find members who know those things and are willing to share it and willing to facilitate it. I tell this story often about how my son, who was about 8 years old, went to a Bristlebot makerspace program at the Fayetteville Library. And the librarians had it all prepared. And you do Bristlebots. What you do is you take a toothbrush, you clip off the bristles, and onto the bristles you attach an old pager vibrating motor, which made it go bzzz in your pocket, and a watch battery to make it go. And when you do that, it will vibrate along the table, and you can race them and put them in patterns and make them do mazes and such. The problem was that the librarians who had gotten all the materials and organized it bought little itty-bitty watch batteries. And these vibrating motors just went through them in seconds. And so the problem was that after about 5 minutes, all the kids were looking around, and none of the Bristlebots were moving, and all the librarians moved to a corner to say, what are we going to do? You going to go buy the battery? Can we buy the battery? Do we have the money to buy the battery? And while they're having this discussion about how they are going to save the session, the kids start going, anyone got a AA battery? And they began attaching AA batteries, and they realized it would vibrate a lot. And then they realized, why clip the bristles off? If we duct tape three toothbrushes together, we get a bristle tank and a bristle carrier. And pretty soon they were having bristle battles. And it was almost instantaneous, because it happened to me at the same time the librarians. We looked at what was happening. We realized how much better what was happening. What was happening is that the librarians weren't leading them through an exercise where the librarians were experts in dishing out what they knew to the users, to the customers, to the consumers. What was happening is the members of the library were using a library space, using a library time, using a library idea, and teaching themselves and learning themselves. And I have to say, when we left, my 8-year-old was like, that is the best library ever. Why? Not because the librarians were brilliant, but because he was brilliant in the library. That's why we don't have customers and consumers and users. A good library has members, community members, be they faculty and students, be they truckers, be they lawyers, be they doctors, be they parents, be they kids. We're members. And the library is of the community, not for the community, not an outside part of the community, not something that can be outsourced, but of and integral to the community. That as the value and prosperity of the community rises, so does the prosperity and value of the library. Ultimately, the success of a great library is not in its volumes and not in its gate counts and not in things that we can touch and count upon, but in the dreams and aspirations of the community. It's in what happens because of the library, not what's in the library. And so now I come back to why I'm showing you all my wires and chemicals and chemo coming in and my bald head and wonderful things. Because there's something very interesting happening in medicine. And I think that medicine can learn from a lot from libraries, but those collection-centric libraries can learn a lot by what's going in medicine. And that is, when I look at treatment, it's not a matter of a doctor coming in and saying, you're sick, you're a bunch of symptoms, here's the cure, and walk away. Instead, what happens is the doctors and the nurses, myself and my wife and my whole community come together to say, Dave has cancer, we're going to cure it. Sure, the doctor is prescribing medicine, but the community members are making sure that my house is perfectly clean when I'm immune compromised. My wife makes it work because she takes care of the kids while I'm getting chemicals. It happens because when I let the library community know that I was diagnosed with cancer, sure, the first thing that happened was every librarian became a medical reference librarian, and I received thousands and thousands of emails, which were brilliant about, this is Hodgkin's lymphoma, and these are the treatments, and here's the chemical, and here's what you should think about, and get a juicer. That was odd. And the idea that they came together and they started with the reference. But what they learned and what I learned is what I needed was, Dave, you're going to be okay. Dave, I'm here for you. Dave, is there anything I can do for you? Dave, let me tell you a story about my father who was diagnosed and was supposed to be dead in 3 and is now living 20 years later. Those stories, that community, that expertise, yes, the reference, yes, they could find Medline. But ultimately, they came together to say, Dave, you're worthwhile. Dave, a library and librarians are about community. Just as my doctor and my nurses and my wife and my family and my work form a community for me getting well. And by the way, evidence and study after study shows that patient-centered care, when the patient doesn't simply receive treatment but is actively involved in thinking about it, crafting it, understanding it, and shaping it, they have better outcomes. So too we need to think about member-centered libraries. Not user-centered libraries, not did we serve them well, not did they come in and were they satisfied customers, but did they come in and contribute? Did they come in and share with us their dreams and aspirations? Did they come in and share their successes? Because just as the success of my doctor will be my health, not their treatment, the success of your library is not in your collection and not in your services and not in your gate count, but whether the member came in and did something amazing and incredible. That's what it means to be a great library, and that's what it means to be a great librarian. A professional librarian is not someone who knows everything. It's not even someone who can find everything. It's someone who can build and make a member feel like they're the most important person in the world. Your collection, It's not your books and not your space and not your service and not your license. Your collection is your community. Your collection is their success. Your collection is sharing their success. When someone comes to your library, can they learn about the brilliance of your community? Or do they learn about where your building is and how to search a database? When someone comes to your library, do they learn about the people, their names, their faces, their values, and how their life is better? Or do they learn how to search the catalog? It's about community. It's about greatness by the success of others. It's what makes the librarianship the most noble profession I know of. It's why treating people as if treating their illnesses and curing them, their health, is something preserved for doctors. But the truth is, we're all healthy in different ways. We're healthy because we can dream and we feel supported. We're healthy because we know someone will help us. We're healthy because we're important. And libraries can provide that to our communities. You can provide that to your communities. Go out and be great. Thank you very much.